Okay, our next talk of the session. Our next talk of the session is Andrew Hipsley, Gregory Stump, and Raphael Finkel, all of the University of Kentucky, and the talk is Computing in the Field, Language Modeling for Elicitation and Documentation of Schuppenkopf.
And there is a handout for this. Does anybody not have that?
There are different points in here.
Okay, I think... Okay, in this paper we talk about a methodology of automated elicitation and documentation that we've put to use in a large-scale research project devoted to the Schuppenkopf language. This project is actually a collaborative effort involving a group of 8 students and faculty from the University of Kentucky and 4 members of the faculty at Khorog State University in Tajikistan, 3 of whom are also members or associated with the Tajik Academy of Sciences. And this project really got off the ground last summer. We got funding for a summer workshop for which we invited 3 members of the faculty of Khorog State University to come to Lexington, Kentucky, and to participate in a month-long workshop devoted to beginning the collaboration on the creation of a grammar, a comprehensive grammar of the Schuppenkopf language. And so you see here the 3 people that we had, Mukbilsho Alamshoyev, Shonazar Mirzoyev, and Gulmuro Mirzofoyeva. During the workshop, we made use of the facilities of the Collaboratory for Research and Computing for the Humanities at the University of Kentucky. We met here daily, and this was a very important facility for us to make use of for the research that we're talking about here, because it allowed us to make instantaneous and very extensive use of computing technology in the course of our discussions. A little bit about the Schuppenkopf language. Schuppenkopf is spoken in Tajikistan. In particular, it's spoken in the eastern, very mountainous part of Tajikistan, in the midst of the Pamir Mountains. It is spoken by approximately 40,000 people in Tajikistan, also by another 20,000 in neighboring parts of Afghanistan. The principal language, the official language of Tajikistan, is of course Tajik. This is the language of government and commerce, education and the media. And as a consequence, Schuppenkopf is not really a written language at all. All of the writing takes place in Tajik. Tajik is a language related to Schuppenkopf, but only distantly. It's not mutually intelligible with it. Schuppenkopf is, like Tajik, an Indo-Iranian language. In particular, it's a southeastern Iranian language belonging to the Pamir subgroup. And all of these Pamirian languages are spoken in the Pamir Mountains in eastern Tajikistan. Schuppenkopf is actually the most widely spoken among those. It is indeed a kind of lingua franca by means of which speakers of these other smaller and even less well-documented Pamirian languages communicate with one another in case they don't have a native language in common. There has been work done on Schuppenkopf over the years. In no language does there exist a comprehensive grammar of the language, but there has been work on grammatical description done in Tajik, also in Russian, and to a very limited extent in English. Also work on the history of Schuppenkopf has been conducted. In particular, I want to point to a very important series of articles by John Payne on this topic. And there are a couple of good dictionaries of Schuppenkopf by Karim Shoyev and Zarubin, mentioned at the bottom there. Now, in our work during the summer workshop, we were mainly interested in morphological elicitation. Particularly, we were interested in the verb system of the language, which it turns out is quite elaborate. It has an elaborate system of tense aspect inflections, only a fragment of which are represented in this sample paradigm. What's interesting in this paradigm particularly is the expression of agreement, because you can see that in the non-past tense, agreement is expressed synthetically by means of suffixes added to the verb, but in the past tense, also in the perfect and the pluperfect, agreement is instead expressed by means of a second position clitic in these examples, situated on the subject pronoun in each sentence, but really situated on whatever constituent happens to be first in the sentence. And verbs in this language fall into two major conjugations, the default conjugation being represented here, and then the other less widely exemplified conjugation represented in this case, the verb stand. And what's interesting here is that this is a verb that is both middle and intransitive. And these verbs are interesting in the past tense, where they involve a slightly different inventory of second position agreement clitics. They also express agreement in the main verb stem with respect to gender and number, which the verbs in the default conjugation do not. And we'll see more about both of these types of verbs momentarily. And in the process of studying the inflectional morphology of Shugni, we were particularly interested in postulating entire paradigms. In a language whose verb morphology is this rich, it doesn't simply suffice to hypothesize individual piecemeal verb forms, but rather to actually postulate entire paradigms. And for this purpose, the computer technology of morphological generation is, in fact, extremely well-suited. So we actually used a computer program generating morphological forms in Shugni. We integrated this directly into the elicitation progress, a process in the collaboratory setting, which the summer workshop took place. And we had native speakers on hand who were able to evaluate the paradigms generated by our computer programs. And right on hand, we could actually, in real time, modify the program itself so as to accommodate the judgments of the speakers that we consulted. And the most suitable sort of morphological generation program for use in this kind of process is one that models morphology as a default inheritance hierarchy. This is basically, you think of it as a tree diagram that lists general characteristics high up in the tree and more specific characteristics farther down in the tree. This is a default inheritance hierarchy in the sense that it is possible for the very broad generalizations listed high in the hierarchy to be overridden by the more specific generalizations listed farther down in the hierarchy. The nice thing about this type of computer program is that it allows the morphology of the language to be modeled very succinctly, and it also allows revisions to be made very quickly and easily. A single revision can actually have wide-ranging implications throughout the morphology of the language with this type of technology. To formulate the default inheritance hierarchy for Shugni, we used the formal language known as Catter, and this is actually an outgrowth of a formal language devised by Gerald Gasdar and Roger Evans, known as Datter. And this is actually the language of the examples that Andrew will be talking about momentarily. In theoretical terms, the description that we formulated for Shugni followed the assumptions of realizational approaches to morphology, such as the approaches of network morphology and paradigm function morphology. And here is our initial theory of Shugni verb morphology, inflectional morphology. And you can see this looks rather technical. Don't really worry about that. You should mainly think of this this encoding as defining a tree, an inheritance tree, in which these are characteristics of the topmost node, the most general node, called verb. And then these are the two daughters of that node, called middle verb and active verb. These correspond to the two conjugations that I was talking about. And these list the distinctive characteristics of those two conjugations. Agreement and subject pronoun list specific sorts of information about agreement and subject pronoun form to which the verb node needs to make occasional reference. But again, the general idea behind this hierarchy is that the verb node contains very general properties of the language that are presumably instantiated in the inflection of all verbs, and then its daughter nodes, middle verb and active verb, contain more specific generalizations about particular conjugations, and these lower-level generalizations can, in fact, override what would otherwise be inherited properties from higher up in the hierarchy. I'll turn it over to Andrew now.
Okay, what this buys us is a very parsimonious way of encoding verbs in the language. So, just grab my So, for example, that's the verb to disturb. All right, given all Greg's nice theory, we can have the verb to disturb just encoded like this. And when it comes to our elicitation, we say, Shugni speaker, is that right? Okay? And the Shugni speaker, and you can pretend you're Shugni speakers right now because you have the handout of the real results. All right? So you look at that and you say, yeah, that's absolutely fine, completely predicted by our model. Okay? This is how we've developed our idea of what Shugni is. We say, well, we have a theory, which is this computational model of the language, and the theory is based on the fact that it gives word forms which a Shugni speaker agrees with. And we keep on documenting the language, and that means we find another lexical entry which is different. It's a non-standard type. We plug it into the model, but the model doesn't know it's non-standard, and it goes and produces the same predicted forms. The Shugni speaker is not happy this time and says, no, that's wrong. Instead of getting our field notebook out and just documenting that particular item as wrong, we say, let's make the theory, let's manipulate the theory so it derives the right forms for the Shugni speaker. And that way we'll have a new theory, okay, which the speaker has helped us create. Okay? And it's cyclic. We get the new theory now. We have forms that all Shugni speakers agree with, and then suddenly we stumble across another non-standard lexical entry. Shugni speakers aren't happy. Instead of doing something about the item, we manipulate the theory so that item could also be incorporated. We have a third type of theory. Okay? So this is kind of how it works. We have cycles of refinement, okay? Cycles of theorems, in other words, the paradigms of the verbs, cycles of interaction with the speaker, and then a brand new theory at the end of it, all incremental. So I just thought I'd give you a quick demonstration of some of the way this works. We had a very innocent looking at lexical entry for buzz. We thought nothing of it. It's encoded in exactly the same way as disturb. But when we generate the forms and we give it to the Shugni speaker, she says, hang on, you can't say that. Why can't you say that? Well, if you compare that, what I have there, to what you have in the handout of three, you'll see there are certain differences. Our model predicts T's in here and Z's in here, and it's just all over the place. The Shugni speaker has D's and J's instead. You think, well, how serious is that? Is the Shugni speaker saying something about this verb buzz, or is she saying something about the language? And she's saying something about the language. She's basically saying, that marker you've got for past tense is a T, and that's correct. But we have a Sandi rule in the language, and that says that if your stem is in a voice obstruent, then you change the T to D. That's what she's telling us. She's not telling us about buzz at all. Okay. So likewise with Ch, you change that to a J. It's a voicing assimilation. We encode that in our grammar, in our theory, and then there's no problems. Okay. And it has wide implications for every single time we get a lexical entry, which just happens to have a stem in a voiced obstruent. Okay, so there's the correct theory. Here's another example. The verb to see. Again, we think this is an innocent one. We look at our grammars. It just looks like any other standard lexical entry. Okay, and if you compare what we have generated from our model with what you actually see in the handout, you'll see that there is difference. And what the difference is that the Shugni speaker says to us, hang on a minute, you can't have short eyes here. You can't have short eyes all the way in here. Okay, so it's completely and utterly wrong. Okay? Is the Shugni speaker saying something about this particular verb to see, or is she saying something about her language? So we think, well, she said something about her language last time with the Sandi rule, so let's think of it as something much more general. We could say that maybe this verb happens to have extra information that you need to encode. You have to say, well, the stem in the past is a little bit different from the stem in the present. Okay, length of I. And third person singular, that's a little bit different as well. Well, we could say, no, it's not so much about this verb. It's the fact that the past stem and the third person present stem coincide in the language. Okay? So instead of having a rule that says every time you want to use the past tense, use the present tense, we say, let's elaborate that rule and say, no, every time you use the past tense, don't use the present tense. Use specifically the third person singular present tense, just in case there's an alternative. Okay? And that works beautifully, it turns out. So we've got this verb to know in 5 in the handout, and that's something we could predict. We could really impress our Shugni speaker. How did you know that? Well, we knew your third person singular was different, and we predicted that the past tense would also be different in exactly the same way. Okay? And then, more importantly, it comes to a verb like knit, which is in 6 in the handout, and we now find out that the Shugni speaker really is telling us something different about a lexical entry rather than the language. Here in knit, what's at issue is the third person singular and the past don't coincide. Do we throw away this generalization about the language which works so well for so many verbs, or do we say, no, now she really is telling us something special about knit. It's exceptional. It has a special past tense form. So there, that goes down to our field notes about that particular verb. Our theory stays intact. Okay. This is a very interesting last point to make, and that is the verb to see. This belongs to the group that are middle, which means they do have a gender distinction in the past and perfect tenses. Okay? So we know that that's going to happen, right? So we are anticipating a special masculine singular stem. Okay? On the other hand, our generalization says that the third person singular is the same as all the other past stems. Okay? And we generate something like this. Now, if you compare this to what is in the handout, which is, well, who's this? Yeah, 7. It kind of looks a bit of a mess. We've got this correct, but we seem to have all this a little bit wrong. Right? We should have verovt, but we have verovst. Here's the interesting thing. We could throw this out and say our theory made a wrong prediction. Or we could say it nearly got it right. It nearly got it right. We have verovst and verovt, and they're so close. And it moves us on to explore the issue. What is it that we need to do to verovst to make it verovt? Okay? You say, well, maybe there's more morphology in here than we thought. Maybe this S here is actually attached to an underlying root in V, okay? And the S is unvoiced so that V becomes F. And maybe that S is some kind of marker that we've never come across before, right? And that, of course, would give you verov in the past tense and the T becoming D because of our obstruent rule. Okay, so we sort of puzzle upon that. There's another example of how we can work this. Okay, so we end up with a much more enriched lexical entry. We knew about the third person singular masculine anyway. We now have supply third person singular present. We are still out there trying to figure out what the cert is doing to this, verov, to make it verov. Okay, and we then have to explore what is the feminine sen in a singular and come across with veriv. Okay. On the way, we've sort of discovered different ways the model gets things wrong and different ways we have to repair it. There are 3 different kinds of generalization, overgeneralization, I should say. Firstly, the example where we have the rule perfectly correct and it predicts all the right forms, it's just we didn't know that it had a second component. So we have a rule that says if you form a past tense, use the t. Okay, and that's absolutely true. What we didn't know is that there's a morphological rule targeting the ter, and if the stem is in a voiced obstruent, it changes the ter to a der. We didn't know it. Shugni speakers helped us supply the extra component of the rule. Okay? So that's how we refine it. We add something complementarity to the rule. Okay? The other one is where our rule seems to overgeneralize. It gives us too many forms that are alike, and it doesn't discriminate amongst items which don't necessarily need those forms. We have a rule that says the stem in the past is the same as the stem in the present. That's too powerful, too general. Sometimes the third person singular is distinct from the rest of the forms in the present. Okay? So we need to override that rule. Okay? We need to override that rule, and we have a rule which is sometimes accurate, but sometimes not. It needs to be rescued by overriding. The last one is one of the most interesting of all. Here we have a rule that we think is absolutely perfect because it seems to make the right prediction nearly all the time. Okay? And that is the past and the stem are exactly the same. Okay? But it's doing it by accident. In fact, the real rule is the past is the same as the third person singular. It's just that some verbs, there is no distinction between the third person singular and the other forms in the present. So we never actually saw that to the point. Then when suddenly it comes along that there is a third person singular distinction, then we have to refine the rule and say, no, it wasn't quite the way we thought it was. Phew, okay. So in conclusion then, we're using technology in a special sort of way. We're using it to generate paradigms which are kind of there for judgment, acceptability judgments for our speaker. They're hypotheses. They're very, very accurate, okay, according to a theory, because they're computationally based, and they're very, very quick. But we can refine the theory by using our consultant and refine it through extension, overrides, and substitution of rules. The main thing is that the collaborator is all important in the process. The collaborator is our systems evaluator, as it were. Right? If you think of this as a kind of systems analysis and design project, she's there to help us evaluate. What's the outcome of the whole enterprise? We have a formal grammar of the language, something which is robust, which is something you kind of want if you have a choice. And it's informed by the consultant at every stage of its incremental refinement. Okay, thank you.
We have about 9 minutes for questions.
How did you actually present these generated forms to the informant? Did you try to put them into context? Or did you just give them the bare forms? And was it difficult to find an informant who would easily give you judgments in this context?
Yeah, well, let's just put this picture. I mean, it was a sort of, it came about almost by accident. We have Raphael Finkel on our team, who's a computer scientist, and the workshop was a little bit like a traditional dissertation process, where we'd have the should-be speakers there, and we'd be talking to them and asking them about their language, especially the verb system. And it was his idea to just try and model what we knew so far. And he presented these paradigms, yeah, with sentences that he hard-coded into the data, like, I am kicking the camel, or I am kicking the horse, of course. So we have all these sentences, but inside those sentences were the morphology bits, which we were really after. Okay, and because it's sort of presented in a rather sort of pretty way with these nice colourful tables, they could respond to those tables and say, yeah, we like that and we don't like that. And there could be argument and debate amongst themselves as to what is the singular, feminine singular form, and whether camels are really masculine or feminine, which of course got straight off the topic, so we have to bring them back down to the main point, which is the morphology. And then the real beauty of it was this, that if they disagreed with a verb form, well, Raphael Finkel would just change his theory while we were talking and then press the button and then there'd be a whole set of new verb forms for them to respond to.
I'd like to add something to that, and that is that because we were working in this collaboratory for humanities computing, we were actually able to use Raphael's program to project the very paradigms that Andrew was using as illustrations onto the screen behind Shonazar in this picture here, great big, so that all of the Shogi speakers sitting there could simply sit and evaluate them from their seats. Everybody's seeing exactly the same thing, and of course, Raphael changing the output as we went along. It is important to recognize, too, that the three Shogi speakers with whom we were working are themselves, all of them, trained linguists. And as a consequence, you know, the idea of looking at things in paradigm format was completely unproblematic for them. They were used to looking in English and Russian and Tajik in this way, and so for sure we made no obstacle at all.
I have a question.
Yeah.
To kind of follow up on that, how did it work in terms of the, for example, some of the allophonic processes that seem to be going on in the morphophonemics? Because people could be trained linguists but still be unaware of dimensions of their own language. So I was kind of curious about that.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, trained linguists aren't necessarily sensitive to allophonic variation, and that was one of the things that we had to be trained to do to pick up on. And we would have to have a consensus that what we were hearing was a voiced segment, not an unvoiced segment. And then, of course, we would quietly go away and have afternoon sessions with them in private, and we'd try that on, sort of make a difference between whether it's voiced or unvoiced. Of course, if they react violently, then we know that their allophonic intuition is passively there, at least. So, yeah.
I have to add, too, that during this process, we would sometimes get a very strong and very certain disagreements between the three people that we were consulting with. And it seemed to reflect the fact that the two older people that we had invited really seemed to have a more conservative variety of the language. The younger woman really seemed to speak sort of young people, showed me with really quite a distinctive number of differences. And I think this methodology helped bring that out in a very dramatic way.
We still have 5 minutes. Question.
I have a cultural question, and also I want to ask something about the elders and the younger people, the speakers. So how many speakers do you, this language have, and then how did you face about the difference of elders and youngers with this phonological alternation, and how did you, you know, face it, and how did you analyze the data, compare these two variety of different alternations?
At present, I think at the time of the workshop last summer, we were mainly just sort of data gathering. And so to the extent that we noticed differences in what the speakers would accept, we just simply took note of those. And we actually are planning a trip to Korog in Tajikistan to be able to work with larger numbers of people. And these points of disagreement between the three speakers that we had to Lexington are sort of very foremost on our agenda, to try to get a better understanding of exactly what the dimension of variation there are among older speakers, younger speakers, urban speakers, rural speakers. It's also true that Shugbi is spoken both in Tajikistan and in Afghanistan. Tajik Shugbi has undergone over the years much more Russian influence than the Shugbi spoken in Afghanistan ever did. So that's a dimension of variation also. So present, we're mainly just trying to gather evidence and use it as a basis for gathering more of the evidence, and then eventually trying to get a clear sociolinguistic picture of the nature of variation in this language.
Yeah, part of the question was how many speakers there are.
According to what I've read, there are 60,000 speakers, most of whom are in Tajikistan, but some of whom are in Afghanistan. So certainly in comparison with some of the languages under discussion at this conference, it's not as clearly as endangered. The thing is, though, that it is underdocumented, because it really is a spoken language rather than a written language. Also, we see the work that we're doing on Shugbi as being an essential first step towards approaching some of these very small Pomerian languages for which Shugbi is essentially the kind of operative lingua franca. So this is part of a bigger undertaking.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Question. Does the term symbol operate in other contexts? A little bit more about that.
Okay. Well, what we know so far,
yes.
It seems to be definitely more phonological. It's not automatic. So it definitely targets that marker of past tense, which is t. What it doesn't do is it doesn't cross a word boundary. So there's a future tense. It's a future adverbial marker in TA. And if the stem is in a voiced obstruent, it leaves that alone. Now, it's a good question, of course, because that's not inside that model at this point. We need to add something to say, stop it doing its work across the word boundary. So we'll gather up all these idiosyncratic phonological rules on the way. That's what we hope.
Well, if there's no more questions, thank you. I think we're at lunch break now, is that right?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't hit the double.
Just single.
Single.